What's cracking, folks? Welcome back to the Quo Vadimus podcast. We're not going to bother with the whole this is what the theme is intro anymore. I think at this point, if you're listening, you know what the deal here is. So today my guest is Michael Levin of Liberty Ballers, the SB Nation Philadelphia 76ers blog. One of the smartest and most knowledgeable guys about the Sixers that there is. Obviously, the Sixers, when you're talking about them, you're going to be talking about the future, so it's a pretty good fit here. And Michael and I talked for about an hour about a whole bunch of things 76ers related, what their overarching plan is, which of the guys on the team might be sticking around for the future, what kind of players they might be looking for in next year's draft and beyond. Good conversation. Let's get you guys to it right now.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for coming on. How are you doing today?
I'm all right, man. How's everything with you?
I'm doing fine. Obviously, we're here today to talk about the Sixers. I have a game between two actual basketball teams on in the background right now.
Watch yourself.
Of course. Well, I shouldn't make fun because my team is worse. And they tried
yeah,
to be a real
team. Decidedly worse.
Decidedly worse. And they tried to be a real team. That's the second year in a row that's happened. That, you know, the Sixers didn't try to be a real team, and another team did, and that other team was worse.
We were there before. I've been there with the Eddie Jordan Sixers. So
the Eddie Jordan feeling. Sixers that ran like the worst Princeton offense I've ever seen.
I don't think it was a Princeton offense. I think calling it a Princeton offense is like having a pig and being like, well, I can't finish this metaphor because it was so bad. That's why. I went blindly into that metaphor. And I was like, I'll figure something out. And I couldn't get anything. So I just ended it and started yelling. That's where I left that.
That's actually, you know, a pretty good metaphor for that team. They just went into the offense, and then they wound up yelling.
And that was exactly my point. Way to circle back around that for me. Appreciate it.
So anyway, obviously, you know, this podcast, which I've, you know, told myself very often that I'll do more of and never quite get around to it. You know, we talk about, you know, strictly the future of, you know, whatever my guest is an expert in. So, yes, I'm calling you an expert on the Sixers, and we're going to talk about, you know, what else is there to talk about with the Sixers other than the future. You know, we're not interested in arguing the merits of tanking. We're just going to accept, you know, sort of what the Sixers are doing at face value and talk about sort of the overarching plan behind what they're doing. And, you know, the reason that I wanted to bring you on is because I read something you did at Liberty Ballers the other day, and I thought it gave sort of a good overview of, you know, the general philosophy that they're engaged in right now as it related to, you know, the Michael Carter-Williams trade and the KJ McDaniels trade. So why don't you just sort of take us through that a little bit, sort of as you see it, you know, the overarching philosophy behind what they're doing. You know, not just, oh, they're trying to be as bad as possible and get picks.
Sure.
But sort of the, you know, the larger idea behind that.
Yeah, I'll just do broad strokes and give you a little bit of history. The Sixers are trying to be a perennial contender. That's really what, I mean, it's almost as simple as that. And what the best way to be a contender is have the best players. They don't want to have to, like, you know, Houston did it differently. People did it differently. But the way the Sixers are doing it, which is, you know, maybe isn't the best way or isn't the smart, it's just the way they're doing it. There's no one way to build a championship contender. There's a lot of ways not to. There's a bunch of ways not to. And the Sixers are just trying to do one where they stay as flexible as possible financially and roster-wise so they can either draft a superstar, sign a superstar, or trade for one. And it's hard. It's hard to get a superstar. There aren't that many of them. So the simple thing is they're giving themselves – Hinkie started a year and a half ago. And it feels like a lot longer because a lot of things have happened since then, and only one player from before Hinkie got here remains, and that's Jason Richardson, who played his first game the other night. It's hard. So what they're doing is basically just trying to get a superstar to build around, hopefully two, and just give themselves the most options to acquire one. And that's really it. That's as simple as it is.
Yeah, I was talking about it yesterday with our friend Matt Moore, who I think everybody knows is sort of one of the most vocally against what the Sixers are doing people in terms of, like, actual reasonable people.
I don't know that he's that against it, though. I don't know that he's – did you read the article he wrote today?
I have it queued up in I'm actually looking at a tab. Not yet.
Well, don't read it now. But
right now.
It's it was good. It was a good read, and there's certainly some truth in there. But I don't know that he's that against it. I think he's on board with the broad strokes of it. It's just the specific moves that he can't really get behind. But I think eventually he ends up getting behind all of them anyway. So I don't know. I think A, he's tired of Sixers fans on Twitter, which I don't blame him for at all. Because we are a rambunctious bunch. We used to not be. I'm actually in the process of writing about it now. The Sixers fans, led, I guess, by me and a couple of guys at Liberty Ballers, we used to hate the team, just, like, openly bash them for really everything because they were such a mediocre organization for so long. Like, they drafted Iverson and then tried to build around him for 4 years, kind of failed, and then I still don't – I talked about it today. I talk about it almost every day with just various people. How did that 2001 Sixers team make the finals when they had Iverson and no one else? A 34-year-old Mutombo, George Lynch, Tyrone Hill, Aaron McKee, Eric Snow, young Rajah Bell, who wasn't very good yet, Jermaine Jones, Rodney Buford. Like, no one was good. Like, it was Iverson who's, like, the most unique superstar, I think. Certainly not the best player ever, but I think one of the most unique players ever. And I don't know how they won the first game of that final. So anyway, that's just
they were the only team to beat the Lakers that year in the playoffs.
Yeah, yeah.
They won
that first.
That was one of the all-time worst finals teams. That Sixers team. I've ever seen.
I can't think of anyone that's ever. But I mean, I would put that Sixers team against, like, the Phoenix Suns today, and I would think the Suns win a series against them. Like, they're bad. It was a bad team.
I think more than half the teams in the league today would beat that Sixers team in a series.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No question about it.
We got a little bit off track. So I was talking to Matt, and the reason I said that I think he's against it is because whenever I've talked to him about it, I guess it's been about the moves of theirs that he hasn't liked. So, for example, he didn't like in the draft last year drafting Embiid or drafting Saric. He also didn't like either of the two trades that they made at the deadline. And at first, I didn't like the KJ move, but then I sort of came to view it how you just described it, where, you know, it's only been a year and a half that Hinkie's been job there, and they're still very much in stage one of, you know, sort of their project that they're undergoing, which is superstar acquisition mode. And they're doing whatever they can to get the superstar because they still don't know who it is yet. You know, it might be Nerlens Noel, it might be Joel Embiid, it might be Dario Saric, or it might be whoever they take in the draft this year. But I think that they felt confident that Michael Carter-Williams, given his shooting deficiencies, you know, as many other good skills as he has, you know, he has great size, he's a good rebounder, he has good court vision, he has shown himself to be very good at playing passing lanes on defense, you know, not quite as good as some other things on defense, but I think that they saw, you know, that total package and thought, you know, no matter what else he's good at, the fact that he really can't shoot at all is going to hold him back from being a superstar, and, you know, making this move will give us another chance to get someone who has, not necessarily someone who definitely has a better chance than Carter Williams to be a superstar, but someone who might have a better chance. And,
yeah, I think,
you know,
yeah.
It's just quickly, it's not necessarily kicking the can down the line, but it's more that, you know, I think they'll be in a position to keep a guy like Carter Williams, who probably won't be a superstar, but will also probably be a good player. Once they know who their superstar is, I feel like they'll start keeping guys like that rather than moving them. But because they don't know who the superstar is yet, they're just still trying to give themselves more and more chances to get that guy.
100%. 100%, that's absolutely correct. So, I mean, I don't think they're not always just going to trade guys who aren't, who are like, hey, Marco Williams is a good basketball player and has the potential to be a very good basketball player. They're not just going to keep trading those guys, but they have to until they have a guy they can build around. They have to keep moving him. And what they did with MCW was they maximized his value. I don't think anyone in the league would think that the Sixers could have gotten a potential lottery pick, high lottery pick via the Lakers for MCW this year. He's played mostly bad basketball. His efficiency has dropped. He's a better defensive point guard with the potential to get better. But I think it's amazing that they came away with such a good asset in that Lakers pick. And I don't think that they would have. I don't think there's a shot in hell that they would have gotten that pick had it not been a 14 trade. I think if it was just like MCW for that Lakers pick, I don't think anyone makes that trade in the league. But because there were a bunch of moving pieces happening, no one really noticed, and the Sixers kind of like snuck away with like a really, really great draft pick.
Yeah, I think you also have to consider a little bit, where he wound up going in the deal. You know, he doesn't necessarily fit, what, the Sixers are trying to accomplish. But in Milwaukee, he sort of fits into their ethos of, we're just going to have the biggest, longest athletes possible and smother people on defense that way. And it seems like they're sort of just depending on Jabari to be their guy who's going to score for them. And they're not necessarily worried about how good they were going to be the rest of this season. You know, with Brandon Knight, they would have been better. But now in the future, they have, Carter Williams, they have Giannis, they have Jabari, they have John Henson, they have Chris Middleton. Now that's probably the longest lineup in the league. And
yeah,
it's going to be so tough to score against them. And I think that sort of plays into how they were able to make the deal too, because there weren't very many teams that would probably value Carter Williams the same way Milwaukee did.
Yeah. And I don't think, I think what they're going to try to do is make MCW less of a primary option. On the Sixers, even this year with with some guys that can score a little bit more like Robert Covington, MCW's role in the offense was essentially do everything. And it'll be easier for him, I think, if Kidd can convince him to just be a facilitator and get out in the passing lanes and do and orchestrate the fast break. But you don't have to start every set, you know? So I think that'll help.
If he's not
that'll
running
help
a pick and roll every time. Sorry, keep going.
Yeah. I think that's it.
Yeah, if he's not running a pick and roll every time down, then teams can't go under on the pick and roll against him every time.
Yeah.
And it should help make him a little bit more effective of an offensive player.
Agree. And I hope for his sake that he embraces like a back to the basket game and starts breaking advantage
sort of like
smaller guys there. Like Sean Livingston,
like
Andre Miller.
If Kidd uses him like he used Sean on last year's Nets, I think that's something that makes a lot of sense for him.
Yeah, I want to make clear that this doesn't mean that the Sixers – I think there's a lot of, like, binary reactions to things, either yes or no. They love him, they hate him. I don't think this means that the Sixers hate MCW or never think that he can develop a jump shot. They just have to look at all of the information and they say, okay, we've known this guy for 18 months, and we saw him for a year and then a year where he didn't play at Syracuse. And he's never been a good shooter. Whereas there's guys like Jakarr Sampson and Jeremy Grant and KJ McDaniels to some extent who have gotten better at shooting and made marked improvements. MCW hasn't at all. And so they're looking at all the information and they're saying, well, we're getting offered this really great pick, and we value that a lot. We like MCW. We think he has a chance to be a pretty good player. If he develops this jump shot, he has a chance to be a very good player, but we have to make a decision on it. And so they pulled the trigger. And I don't think that means that they don't like him as a player, or they think he sucks, or they shouldn't have drafted him back in 2013. I don't think that means any of that stuff. I think it's a very immature reaction to just a team looking at all the information and making a decision based on what they know.
I think it also has to be viewed a little bit through the prism of, you know, who Hinkie is and who Josh Harris, the Sixers owner, is, because Harris comes from private equity. So a lot of the things that they're doing is all based on sort of, you know, what's the percentage that X will happen, and is there a greater percentage that Y will happen if we make this move?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a lot of pick gathering is, you know, people have shown in the past that the draft is basically a crapshoot, and accumulating as many picks as possible is the best way to get yourself the hit. And then if you see, like, even if – so because they're in superstar acquisition mode, even if, you know, someone that they picked, like Carter Williams, is, you know, not necessarily a 100% superstar hit, which I think he's not, but is also not a miss, cashing that chip in for another lottery ticket, you know, that's the kind of play that, you know, someone in that background is going to make. Because until they get sort of that foundational piece, they're still in, you know, flip the asset for another shot mode.
Yes. And you have to think, because there's only 2 years of MCW's contract left after this year. So if you think that the Sixers are going to contend in the next 2 years without trading for a star, I don't think it's going to happen. I think they could be on their way in 2 years, depending on how things shake out. But basically, you're going to have to pay him a big contract before you're going to hope to contend with him. And if they're like, well, we're scared of that contract, then they're basically buying themselves 2 more years, at least, depending on when they get the Lakers pick, of rookie scale labor, basically.
Right, and that's the most efficient, you know, in terms of cost per production labor.
Yeah, it's all about rookie deals. Yeah.
Right, rookie deals or like a true superstar on a max contract like LeBron.
100%.
Those are the only deals that really provide that kind of bang for buck in the league.
Yeah. So people say, like, MCW wasn't good. MCW, why aren't you building around MCW? And it's like, well, he wasn't good enough. Like, he wasn't good enough. Did they think he was a good player? Yeah, probably. They probably think he's a good player. And they can he get better? Sure, he can get better. But at the end of the day, they're not just going to build around whoever's there. I think you read the article. I made a dumb analogy of, like, if there's a can of pinto beans in your cabinet, you don't have to just eat pinto beans for dinner. You can go do something else. You don't have to just, like, eat it because it's there. You know, I think it's a matter of, like, there's something better out there. We're gonna flip this and get years of flexibility. And because we know he's not a star, or he probably won't be a superstar, we have to keep moving and maximize value. And that's what they did.
But it's not even something that's definitely better. It's just there's a shot at something better because, you know, like I think you said, you know, better than, you know, you could probably build a nice team around Michael Carter Williams, but that's what they had done for a while. And I think when Hinkie came in, he sort of convinced Josh Harris that that's not really what they want to do. You know, and it must be nice to have that kind of job security to be able to do the kind of things they're doing. I wish anybody had that kind of job security.
The owners are huge.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, just as you were talking about the owners, like, that's they're everything. Like, there's a lot of guys that would do the stuff Hinkie was doing. I think a lot of people in blogging, a lot of the smart, advanced stats guys in blogging would do a lot of what he's doing. But nobody gets that opportunity because owners are generally so, hey, we have to start winning, we have to start winning, we have to start winning. But because Josh Harris buys in, and from every time I've talked to people in the Sixers organization, they're not growing more impatient. They get it. They're on board with none of the picks or the trades would be able to happen if the owners didn't sign off on it. So that's just every time another, you know, what people look at as a move to get worse, which I don't think is the case at all. But people look at that. I think that just looks at me like, man, these owners really are on board with trying to win perennial championships. That's what it says to me, and that's what I want from the team. Like, if that's somewhere you know, if you we were the 8 seed for 45 years. Like, it just felt like just going nowhere, and 10 years of just complete mediocrity, and signing guys like Brian Skinner and, you know, just giving contracts to guys that just aren't going to make a difference. Like, hey, like, if enough people, you know, the Doug Collins in 2012 team, they beat Chicago because Derrick Rose and Joakim Noah got hurt and the Walbang's wrist was, like, falling off. Otherwise, they don't get to play the Celtics in the semis. And, I mean, they're a bad team. They're a bad team that got lucky. And I just – it just frustrates me. It frustrated me for so long to just watch that team make bad decisions and be play boring basketball and be backwards in terms of forward thinking. And, I mean, we definitely get – we as Sixers fans definitely get classified as, like, acolytes or loyalists, which is crazy because we weren't like that before. But just having a plan and watching an organization follow through on what the idea is so rewarding and so obvious to us, I guess. And maybe it's not for other people, and I'm sure we're very annoying as fans to argue with because we just buy in. But, yeah, I mean, that's really all it is. It's having a plan and watching it unfold of we're trying to get the best talent available. And it's really refreshing for us because it's so transparent. Really, it's evident of like they're
very
doing
rare to see a team that's so openly transparent about exactly what they're doing, and then sort of stick to it. You know, the Knicks were trying to operate that way for like 2 years. You know, when they were doing their tear down before their run at LeBron in 2010, obviously that didn't work out, and then they pivoted and signed Amari and Raymond Felton, and then they made the trade for Carmelo, and they were like, okay, well, now we're going to try to get Chris Paul. And then, like, 6 months later, they abandoned that to go get Tyson Chandler, which was great. I love Tyson Chandler. But they're a team that, you know, has never made a plan and stuck to it for longer than, like, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can't even imagine what it's like to root for a team that, you know, says this is what we're going to do and then does it, and then every single move they make, you know, in some way is sticking to that plan.
And people say, like, what has he done? He hasn't done anything yet. And it's like, well, yeah, but nobody does anything until they do something, you know? Like, I think it's just, like, a matter of we're heading in a direction, and it feels just right. They're saying all the right things, and they're acting accordingly. But you want to talk about the KJ trade.
Yeah, because that one I thought was a little bit less obvious on the surface, because a lot of people saw this guy, second round pick, they found him out of nowhere. Obviously the contract situation is what it is, but they cashed it in for seemingly so little value. You know, and they got a guy who looks like a backup point guard and then just another second round lottery pick. Were you on board with, not necessarily with the return they got, but the idea behind the return they got, where it was, you know, we're not going to want to pay him, so we're just going to get whatever we can right now.
Yeah, I will say initially I was underwhelmed by the return. It always made sense to me to trade him, but the return was pretty light, in my opinion. Maybe that's because, you know, I don't know if, because I think he's not out there shopping guys, and I'm sure maybe he would have gotten a better offer from somebody if he was actively doing that. Everybody's available to be traded, but I don't think Hinkie's the kind of guy that's like, hey, we want to trade this guy. You want him? Like, that's not him. But I will say that when Hinkie was in Houston, he was scouting Isaiah Cannon, and then just before the draft, he was the Sixers GM, and wanted Isaiah Cannon, and Houston picked him right before the pick. So then Hinkie like traded back and ended up, you know, just pretty much just getting a couple assets for the future. But he likes Cannon a lot. I don't think he's a starting point guard in the NBA. I think he could be a nice backup. I think shooting is always helpful, and in his first couple games here, he's already shown that, like, hey, he can shoot a little bit. I guess he's only just played the one game so far.
He rained threes when he went down to the league last year.
Yeah, and it's such a difference from NCW. It's such a market difference. But really, what the impetus to trade KJ was, okay, we saw this guy for half a year. We like this stuff. We think he can get better at this stuff. And here's the player he could become. Cool. But he's going to be a restricted free agent this offseason, and someone's going to overpay him.
Right.
No matter what, it takes one team to overpay him a lot. And the alternative to just letting him walk is trying to move him now and get ahead of it. And then when he becomes a restricted free agent in the offseason, the Sixers can offer him a contract. Do I think it's going to happen? Probably not, because I think other teams will offer more. But Sam Hinkie has a number in mind for what he would give KJ and what he thinks KJ's worth. And
I think it's also a little bit of, like, they're entirely unconcerned with something like, oh, like, at least KJ would have kept the fans entertained for the rest of the year. That doesn't matter at all.
No, it doesn't. And I'll say a couple of things. KJ, while the highlights were super fun, the blocks and the dunks were awesome, and I like his defensive potential, and I liked KJ before the draft, I would have taken him if they had a pick at 16 and 32 was a steal. But he wasn't playing that well. His numbers aren't great. Like, his shooting really curtailed, and he's not a great ball handler.
Right, he was
more interesting
has the potential
to be good
than he was actually in practice.
Yeah, yeah. But I still think he's going to be a good basketball player, and I think he'll make a really good pro. But the Sixers have guys on his level that are comparable right now. They have Jeremy Grant, who was drafted 7 picks after him. They have Hollis Thompson, who was undrafted last year. They have Robert Covington, who they just got and who was undrafted. And they have Zakar Sampson. All of those guys play basically the same position. They, you can sort of cycle them 2 through 4 there. But they're basically wings, and they're on the roster for super, super cheap. So when you have those four guys that are like, we're here right now playing good basketball, and we're going to be here for 3 more years being super cheap, why would you want to give KJ, you know, $425? Why would you want to give him that much more money when you already have these other labor for cheaper? So I think there's a certain segment of people that are like, well, they have the cap space, they may as well do it. And it's like, well,
that's how you get yourself in a bad position. Like,
exactly.
You can't
just use this thing
to happen.
Exactly. And yeah, so I like KJ. I think they like KJ. I think they might offer a, I wouldn't be like shocked if they signed in this offseason. But I don't think it's going to happen because I think some team will offer a lot more money and the Sixers are like, well, we have these other guys that are playing for a lot cheaper, so we'll just do it.
I think a lot like Carter Williams, KJ is another guy where if they already knew who their foundational superstar was, then they might have said, okay, well, we know what KJ can be and we know what his role is and we'll keep him, and if he doesn't, you know, bite at our price this summer, well, it didn't happen. But because they don't know who that guy is yet, they weren't comfortable going that route because they don't want to lose guys for nothing at this point, which is probably what would have happened this summer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I will say this. If the Sixers knew that KJ was going to take a one-year deal, then they probably would have drafted.
I was about to say the same thing, yeah.
Yeah. And I would also say that people, there's this narrative that weirdly came out that the Sixers lowballed him with an offer in the draft. That's crazy. That's just crazy and wrong because second-round picks generally don't get paid that much because they're second-round picks. And the Sixers offered him the biggest contract for a second-round pick ever. And he turned it down because he wanted to bet on himself, rightfully so, on a Sixers team where he knew he was going to get minutes and could go to free agency and get more money. So
they didn't lowball him with an offer.
That's all it was.
They just wanted to give him, you know, the 4-year partial unguaranteed special that, you know, gives them more years of control at a low cost. And he said he didn't want to do that, which is totally understandable.
Right.
But
from both sides.
Guys, though. No, go ahead, and then we'll move on to the other guys.
The other thing I was going to say about KJ, what was it? I don't remember. Sorry, keep going.
All right, so there are... you know, obviously, I would say that at least some of the guys on the team will be around in the future. I'm not going to include in the discussion someone like Noel or Embiid because I think that they're pretty clearly more likely than not to stick around.
Maybe. Mm-hmm.
But who of the other guys on the team, not necessarily do you think they want to stick around, or actually we'll go with both. Like, do you think there's anybody that you would like them to keep that you think the team also agrees, or you think you would like to keep but the team might not necessarily agree? Out of guys like Robert Covington and Hollis Thompson and Jeremy Grant, Jakob Sampson, Malcolm Thomas, I think is still on the team. I can't even tell anymore.
No, they just got him. They just got Malcolm.
They just got him.
They just cut him.
Oh, they cut him. I would say that of their top guys, I would say Tony Roten definitely not sticking around. Bob Mute more than likely not sticking around unless they decide to keep him as like a veteran minimum, veteran leadership type guy. Jay Rich almost definitely gone at the end of his contract unless the same thing, but I doubt it. So are there any guys currently on the roster that you think that they would view as sort of complementary pieces to whoever their superstar guy is going to be that they would probably want to keep around? And just the same for, in your opinion, guys that you think have the skill sets necessary to stick around?
Well, I think it's a yes and a no. I think they like Tony Roten. I think they'll keep trying to make him a better shooter, and they'll see what the market's like for him if someone wants to make a trade. I don't think it's ever going to be something like, oh, well, we're never going to trade this guy. For me, it's like because not only are they trying to get a superstar through the draft, they're trying to get enough, enough interesting young pieces to where a team that can't sign one of their superstars will trade them to the Sixers. Like what happened with James Harden, like what happened with Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen, rather. And I think that's the idea, is that you look at those packages of what it took to get James Harden, which Sam Hinkie was instrumental in getting, by the way, was like not a ton of stuff, It wasn't like they weren't blown away. Most times it doesn't happen super often, but when teams are like, hey, we can't sign this guy, or we have a superstar and we need to rebuild or something, then they look around the league and they try to say, okay, like, let's get the best package. And the Sixers, along with like the Suns and the Celtics, I think, are one of those young teams that have first round picks to spare and young, attractive assets that could be like, hey, we'll take him. He could be something. Also, maybe that. And so I think that's the idea, is they're trying to get everybody better. Robert Covington's here for 4 years on the Chandler Parsons special. I mean, like, he's making nothing. It's great. Not for him, but it's great for the Sixers because they took a shot on this guy that they saw a talent in, and he's maximized his ability on this team. But if someone was like, hey, we want Robert Covington in this trade for the bigger piece, then they'll go. Everybody will go. I would not be, like, 100% shocked if no one from the current Sixers is on the next Sixers championship team or contending team. And that could be in 3 years. But that's just because the way they look at things is everything's in flux until we have that one piece to build around. Now, maybe it's Embiid, and I think they might think that. There was a report today that Embiid was shocked at the deadline, which is sort of false. Everybody's available. Like, if they offered Anthony Davis for Embiid, the Sixers are going to do it. Like, everybody's available always, but that's just the way Hinkie operates. But yeah, in terms of, what guys are going to stay long-term, who knows? Like, I think they like a lot of these guys. I know they like Jeremy Grant. I know they like the production that they're getting from Jakob Sampson lately. He's improved every month. It's really impressive how he's gone from, like, looking very lost to now being, like, kind of an attack mode guy on offense. It's really impressive. And he's so good protecting the rim as, like, a small forward. It's awesome. I think they find value in all these guys. And a bunch of them can be very nice complementary players when the superstar reveals himself. but I don't think any of them would get in the way of the Sixers making a trade for one, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And, you know, I think a lot of people just assume that they're only trying to use the draft to get whoever their superstar guy is because,
right.
On the most surface level, what the plan seems to be is to be really bad to get high draft picks. But you know, by accumulating so many draft picks and so many young players with potential, you know, that's how you make trades for superstar guys. Like, you know, not only did Cleveland give up, you know, the Andrew Wiggins pick to get Kevin Love, but they also gave up Anthony Bennett, who was another first-round pick. And, you know, you need multiple pieces like that. You know, like the KG trade, it was Al Jefferson, and it was, you know, some
Lyon
other
Dome.
Was more first-round picks.
Gerald Green, yeah.
Right, just being able to have the combination of young players and picks and cap relief is generally what gets you in the mix for those superstar-type trades. If you're the Knicks, you throw in every single one of those things and more. If you're a smarter team, you try to hold back as much as you can in keeping whatever you can get to get the guy you want.
Yeah, that's really what it is. I think there's a sense of people ask, like, okay, when's it going to be? When's it going to be time? And it's like, they don't know. Nobody knows. I mean, they're just trying to get the best possible team and trying to make each move leading towards the idea that we could get a superstar and then build around them.
Right.
There's no, like, I don't think there's any, like, the plan is just a theory. It's not a, okay, 2015, we do this. 2016, we do this. It's just like everything is working towards this one singular goal.
Right. The star happens when it happens, and then that's when we start moving on a timeline. You know, too many teams, I think, when they try to enter this rebuilding thing, are like, we're going to have our star by X year, and it's going to be draft in X draft. And then we're going to move along at this pace. And, you know, they try to skip steps. It's something I always get angry about with a lot of teams.
Absolutely. You can't cut corners.
Yeah, you know, and I'm a fan of a team that routinely does it all the time, but we won't talk about them. I do want to talk about Noel a little bit because I think that, you know, the guys that are currently playing, it seems like the guy that's, you know, I know, like you said, everybody is available. But of the guys that are currently playing on the team, he seems like the most obvious. This is a piece that is going to be useful for us in the future. You know, whether it's as the superstar guy or whether it's just as this is our defensive anchor center type guy. What do you see as sort of, you know, the future, not necessarily ceiling, but the future archetype for his play? You know, with centers these days, you know, it seems like there are a lot of different directions that they can go. You know, there's sort of the Tyson Chandler mold, which I think is becoming much more popular, where, you know, it's sort of an all-court coverage guy on defense. And then, a pick-and-roll master on offense. You know, then you can also have sort of, you know, the Roy Hibbert or Joakim Noah mode, where it's more they hang back and protect the rim. There aren't many guys that combine both. You know, obviously Tyson Chandler protects the rim as well, but he's still more of a, you know, coverage of space guy than he is, you know, I'm going to stand in front of the rim and not let anybody shoot there. Which direction do you see as sort of the archetype for Noel?
I think a guy like Joakim Noah is what they're looking at. I think we don't know yet, just because a lot will have to do with what happens when Embiid gets here, when he's healthy. I really, really hope, this is just my own selfish thing, that we get a chance to see Embiid and Noel play together for extended period of time. You know, if Noel gets traded this offseason before Embiid plays, I think that would just be a bummer because I want to see those guys play together and see how they do. Noel, he has so much to work on still, that it's almost like it's hard to predict how good he's going to get because he's so far away. But what he does well is, you know, he's already a tremendous shot blocker and a great rim protector, and he doesn't foul that much, which is impressive. And he's really, really good at, even though he's 6'11", like poking the ball away from smaller guards and forwards. He's got really quick hands on defense. So, I mean, defensively is where he's going to make his money. And Sam Hinkie has always said that he loves rim protectors. And you look at, I think, I don't know if it's still the case, but a couple weeks ago there was a list of like the top five opponent shooting percentage at the rim, and like four Sixers were on there. It was like Jakar Sampson, Jeremy Grant, KJ, and Nerland. And that's the kind of stuff he values, is if you're going to get inside, you can't let them score. And I think Nerland's offensive game's coming along. The past couple games, you've seen him be more aggressive. His hands are getting better. He's got like sort of, it's weird because his hands are such a skill on defense, but on offense, like, he's not great at catching yet. And just like taking one power dribble and going up with it. I mean, he's got to get stronger. That's obvious. He's got to get more comfortable, but the jumper is intermittently great. And I think as a weapon, that's going to be helpful. When Embiid plays, he'll really take a lot of pressure off, because Embiid can not only work the game in the post, but he's a really good shooter. Embiid is like a really good shooter, and that'll help space the floor a lot. And that was a big reason, I think, also of why MCW couldn't last here long term, is because even if MCW and Nerlens become like okay shooters, you can't really play those guys together long term if there's not tremendous shooting around them. You know, it's almost a liability. But with Nerlens, I think it's just keep getting better, keep working on it, and see what happens. The only unfortunate thing is that because he had that lost year last year, he's only got 3 years on the rookie scale to improve. So because of that, I'm a little bit worried that next year they trade him, maybe around the deadline. I don't know, maybe draft night, who knows. I hope it doesn't happen, because I think he could really still get better. But yeah, I think it's about rim protection. It's about just dunking. And if he turns into Brandon Wright on the offensive end, I think that is, you know, not that what Brandon Wright does is easy, because he's so crazy efficient, but he's not asked to do that much. He just get offensive rebounds and dunk the ball and be available. Keep your hands up and catch the pass and dunk the ball. And so I think that'll be ultimately his role. And hopefully he becomes more efficient at it. And his shooting percentage has gone up wildly in the past month or so. It's just been improvements. I mean, he had a really low true shooting percentage for a while. And, I mean, it's just going up. I think right now it's somewhere in the, I'm looking at it. It's up to like 475, which is bad, but it was like 44% like a month ago. And so he's taking better shots and he's making shots. And it's really offensively is where he has the most work, but already he's a plus defense player.
Yes, he's already, in our friend Seth Portnow's rim protection metrics at Nylon Calculus, he's 20th in points saved per 36 minutes, you know, right on par with guys like Tim Duncan and Andre Drummond and Alex Len, Omer Asik, guys like that, which is already very impressive, especially because, you know, this is his first season really playing, and, you know, there's a lot more refinement to come in the future. One thing I noticed, I can't remember which game it was I watched shortly before the All-Star break, and I saw him hit a couple of baseline jumpers. He might not have even hit both of them, but they were sort of, you know, taken within the rhythm of the offense. And I thought, well, that looks a lot like how at first the Thunder started stretching Serge Ibaka's role on offense. And I thought that was sort of an interesting way to view it. You know, we are pushing an hour here, though, so I want to move quickly on to, you know, this year's draft. They have, I think, two guaranteed first-round picks and possibly a third and possibly a fourth. Is that right?
Yeah, they have. So they have their own first-round pick, which they would have given up to Boston had they made the playoffs. But finally, those 3 years after the Bynum trade, the deals are it's done after this year, so it becomes 2 second-round picks. So we owe Boston a second-round pick this year and next year. So they have their own pick. They have the Lakers pick, which is top five protected. They have the Miami Heat pick, which they got in the Thaddeus Young trade, which is a ridiculous thing that the Sixers got a probable lottery pick for a year of Thaddeus Young when Minnesota then traded him for Kevin Garnett half a season later.
Right. I was going to say, let's talk about how much the Timberwolves screwed that one up. I'll talk about that with somebody else, though.
Yeah, it was horrible, just awful, and that's, I think that's just flip. The Timberwolves have a bunch of really good prospects, and I think it's all by accident. I don't trust Flip Saunders to do anything well at all, aside from maybe coach a good team, but not this one. And then they have they just got the Oklahoma City Thunder pick for accepting the lovely contract of JaVale McGee, and that is top 18 protected. There's a good chance, I would say, that the Sixers have 3 first round picks.
Yeah,
this year, because
if,
I think,
you know,
Oklahoma City probably gets it.
They could possibly have 4.
They could possibly have 4, and they have 5 second rounders right now. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, so they're probably looking at least 1 top 5 pick, and then, you know, 2 in, you know, the late teens or 20s. So I'm interested in not necessarily who you would want them to pick, you know, of the prospects, because you never know how that kind of thing will shake out. But sort of what archetype of player would you be looking for them to pick, and do you think they'll look to pick with you know, one or all of those 3 selections?
I think you have to look at guys that are that have the potential to be dominant on both ends of the court. I think that is ultimately, if we're looking for superstars, I think that is the idea. And so at least with the first pick, maybe more, but just guys that have the ability to, if we're trying to get superstars, to really change the game on both ends. And so that, to me, sort of rules out Jahlil Okafor. Now, I don't know. I mean, maybe they think the offensive game is good enough where they are willing to sacrifice a mediocre or worse defensive player. But I think you look at a guy like Karl Towns. I think you look at a guy like Stanley Johnson. D'Angelo Russell is incredible on offense. I think Moutier is the same, but neither of them yet are good defensive players. I think Moutier probably has more potential there. But yeah, it's just a matter of guys that, like, who can really make a difference on both ends, and what is what at what position of value. If I had to guess, and this is purely a guess, I don't think Pinky thinks that he's gonna his superstar is going to be a point guard. That would be my guess is that he won't try to make that happen. But I don't think he thinks positionality so much, but point guard is really the one where it's like, there's so many good point guards in the NBA that to really get one that makes a difference, that makes you that much better than everybody else, they have to be so much better than everybody else. So I think he'll look at guys like the ones I named, maybe a foreign guy like Mario Hezonja or Kristaps Porzingis. I mean, I haven't gotten to the point where I've decided, okay, I definitely like this guy or I definitely don't like this guy. But just in trying to think the way that we think Hinkie thinks, which is a lot of things. It seems to be like, guys, the superstar wants to be someone that is dominant on both ends, not just, you know, like a Carmelo Anthony or Steve Nash, where it's only on one end and then sort of a liability on the other.
That sort of is what I thought would be true too. And like you say about the prospects, so many people are declaring, you know, so forcefully, like, oh, Okafor is clearly the number one pick. It has to be him. And then you find just as many people that say the same thing about Town. You know, I feel like for number one, at least, it's become clearly between the two of them. You know, but I don't really just I don't have a preference. Like these guys are both awesome, and you know there are a number of other guys in the top 10 or so that I like as well, and people that are so staunchly in favor of one or the other, I just find it odd because that they refuse to see the merits of the other guy. You know, like you talk to someone who's completely in favor of Okafor, and they're like, oh yeah, well he doesn't have the kind of post move that, or so when you say, well, what about Carl Towns? And they'll say, well, he doesn't have the kind of post moves that Okafor does. And then you talk to someone who thinks it's clearly Towns, they're like, oh, well, he can't. They say, well, oh, Okafor's not very good on defense. He can't defend the rim like Towns can.
And yeah, they're just different players.
Right, they're just different players. And to paint either one of them as complete zeros on one end, I think does a disservice to both of them.
Yeah, and I think the NBA is heading in a Carl Townsian direction. But maybe that works to Okafor's favor in that he's such a different player, you know? I don't know. It's weird. Last year, every year, this is the first year really where I've looked at guys and been like, man, I like all these guys. I don't know. Like, I feel like so many people, like, just jump to, like, okay, I have to have an opinion. I'm going to get this opinion as fast as I can, and I'm going to have one. Right now, I'm just sort of like, yeah, I like a lot of them. We'll see what happens at the combine, and we'll see once we have all the information, then we'll make a decision. And it's going to be fun. I mean, the lottery's going to be fun. I can't wait for it.
I feel like, last year's draft was so hyped up as, like, the amazing, amazing draft. And I feel like there are more players, that I would, like to have on my favorite team this year than there were last year. But that may just be both recency bias and Nick bias because they actually have a first-round pick this year, so I'm predisposed to like more guys. I'm not interested in my own psychology enough to try to unpack that. there are a lot of guys, at the top and then even in the middle of the first round that I think are really interesting and can help a lot of teams in a lot of different ways. But I do want to go back to something you said, though, about the point guards. That Hinky thinks his superstar probably will not be a point guard.
That's sort of my guess. That's just my feeling.
Yeah,
I
hadn't thought of that as it relates to drafting guys. I talked a lot about it last week when there were rumors that the Knicks were going to try to trade for Goran Dragic ahead of his free agency. Now I'm anti-trading for players who will be free agents in 3 months in general in the first place. But specifically, I related it back to point guards because there are so many good ones in the league. It's the easiest position in the league to find a good player at. And giving up so much of your capital in terms of players, picks, and then money also to a guy at that position that isn't necessarily over the top better than everyone else, like a Chris Paul or a Steph Curry or a Russell Westbrook, and I feel like that's really the only three guys probably in that conversation that are sort of like head and shoulders above the rest. Like if you don't have one of those guys, investing a ton of money in that, or I guess I'd probably throw John Wall in there too, but investing a ton of money. I might have thrown Lillard in there at the beginning of the season, but his shooting tapered off too. Investing a ton of money or capital or assets or picks or young players to get a guy at that position who isn't at that level, I feel like is really unwise. And I like that you extended it to the draft too. Spending a lot of draft capital on getting a small may not be as wise, especially when you consider that they're going to cost less on the market than a big guy is because of the big man tax. If you're tall and exist, you can get paid a lot of money. Look at the guy the Sixers just traded for, Javale McGee. It costs exactly as much to get a big man in the draft as it costs as it does to get a small guy, but it costs significantly more in free agency and in trades to do the same.
Absolutely. So, yeah, like, I just totally agree. I think I've always believed that recently, like, positionality is sort of dead for me. I don't think it matters so much. And I've never really valued a big guy over anybody else. But just the way that the league sets the market for everything, you have to consider that, you know? So I don't know. I don't know who they're going to pick. I don't think they know. I think Hinkie, you know, has a couple guys that he likes maybe more than others. And all I'll say is that at this point, like you've been saying this whole time, until you get a superstar, you can't, like, commit to anyone on the current roster. I'll say the same thing about the draft, in that until you get a superstar, you can't draft for fit. You can't draft. You can't say, well, Carl Towns is on top of our board, but, you know, we have Embiid and Noel, so we can't take another one. So,
right. I think they're probably one of the few teams in the league that you can feel confident that no matter who they take, it'll be because they think that guy is the best player or has the most potential to be the best player in the draft. And it's not because he fits some idea of what they need to surround player X. Like, you know, for example, the Knicks are going to go into the draft and the only thing on their mind is going to be which player will be the best fit next to Carmelo Anthony. Like, I just know that that's what they're going to be. That's not at all what I would be thinking because,
yeah.
You know, I don't need to get into it, but it's fairly unlikely at this point that they're going to and it's not because you can't win with Carmelo or any of that nonsense, but just given the roster situation that they're in and his advancing age and now his advancing injuries, it seems fairly unlikely that they'll be serious contenders, you know, before the end of his contract comes up. So,
yeah.
To me, it's just, you know, you pick the guy who's going to be the best and not necessarily the guy who's going to run off. But for the Sixers, I feel like there's none of that in play. It's just going to be, this is the guy we think is going to be the best player eventually. And that's the end of it. And that's sort of the way that you should go in the draft, especially if the main goal is to acquire a superstar, which for the Sixers, it very obviously is.
Yeah. And I think sometimes they'll draft guys with the idea of, okay, we like him, but we know he'll succeed on our team in terms of because just the role that he'll have will be bigger, and we'll flip him from that. I think that's something that they might think about. I would estimate that that's what they did with MCW in drafting him 11th a couple years ago. You know, I think they liked him. I think they might have liked the guy like C.J. McCollum more. I don't know. But MCW was there, and they took him because they needed a point guard because they had just traded Drew. And they knew that he was going to put up stats. And I don't know. I don't want to make – you know, there's for whatever reason, there's been a lot of people that have been like, well, if Sam Hinkie was so great, he would have drafted Giannis over MCW. And it's like, well – everybody misses on everybody. Like, that's no one. Tony Parker was drafted in the late first round. Like, everybody misses. It happens. But I think what, you know, because Giannis looks like such a Hinkie guy in just his demeanor, ability to work, and length, and ability to potentially be a superstar on both ends. Maybe they were just like, you know, we like this guy, but we need a point guard, and we know MCW is going to put up numbers now. And once he does that, either the jump shot will improve and we'll have a near superstar in our hands, or it won't, and we'll trade him. And that's what happened.
Yeah, that's definitely I actually hadn't considered that, and that's really interesting. Just drafting guys, you know, because they're in the position they're in, drafting guys that they know that they can turn it, that they can sort of make look like better players than they might actually be.
Absolutely.
And that's a lot of, you know, why they play such a fast pace. You know, and that that sort of helped Carter Williams win Rookie of the Year, which I think also helped his trade value a little bit. Like, I think that if he had just been the guy he is but hadn't won Rookie of the Year last year, I don't think that they'd get that Lakers pick for him.
Yeah, Rookie of the Year, which is just a, it's just really arbitrary. It's just
right.
Like,
it's just a thing that happened.
It's not, it shouldn't be used to judge him one way or the other, but I mean, he was Rookie of the Year in a weak draft class when most of the guys were hurt and was playing significantly more minutes than everybody else.
And with more responsibility too. Like, he was the guy
plenty more fun. Yeah.
Who everything for that team. And you know, he did a fairly decent job of it. You know, I feel
yeah.
like we sort of gave him sort of the short trip, but he looks like a guy who's gonna be a pretty good player. I mean, you know, he has his merits and he has his things that he's not exactly as good at. And that's true for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Except for, like,
ultimately the Sixers draft guys decide as quickly as they can if they're going to be stars, and if the answer is no, then flip them before their value decreases and while there's still enough time left on the rookie deal. And that's what they did, and they got a really, really good possible pick out of it.
Right. And I think that was sort of all of the questions that I had written down. I did have one additional one, but sort of the way the conversation took us made me realize it was sort of relevant, and it was sort of, you know, when do you view their window for not necessarily championship contention, but for, you know, trying to, you know, put together a real team, you know, and becoming active in free agency and trades that they actively try to acquire better players rather than try to acquire assets.
Yeah.
Like,
when
do you view that?
Yeah.
The way we've been discussing things, it's, we don't know. It'll happen when it happens, and it happens when they get the superstar first.
Sure. There's that.
Right.
But when they came in, the idea is like,
they get the superstar guy.
Right. But the idea is that, like, when Hinkie got here, it was like, okay, this is where the owners said it. It's like, it's going to take 3 to 5 years. And so I think we take them at their word that they thought within the first 3 drafts, maybe we'll get a superstar. Or we'll trade for one. And so I think we're closing in on that. You know, if it's Embiid, or if it's the guy they draft next year, or if it's the guy they trade for, then that, I think, can be taken with, like, all right, so soon, soon. But they said 3 to 5 years. So I think by 2017, 2018, which is Hinkie's fifth year here, they're not on the way towards contending. You know, if they win 19 games every season, then I think, yeah, it will be a failure, not with the plan, not with the idea of the plan, because I was talking to Andrew Sharp about this, I'll always believe in the philosophy that the Sixers are buying into, because it's the easiest, most financially responsible way to try to get a superstar and become a contender. So
well,
I'm always going to buy into
private equity view. You're talking about, you know, you agree with the process, even if the result doesn't turn out the way that you want it to.
Right, right. So that, the process, I'll always agree with. If they're not contending by 2017, 2018, then I will say that is more of a condemning Hinkie's player evaluation ability. That will be, I think, considered a failure, where that will be like, hey, maybe this isn't the guy, even if we all buy into this idea, he hasn't drafted anyone yet or traded for anyone yet that we can build around. And it's been 5 years, so maybe this is the wrong, not the wrong direction to go in, but the wrong person to spearhead it.
And
not only if it's going to happen, but
that's what,
but if
that
it
will be the way it's fun. Like, the spin that comes out of it, if whatever the Sixers are doing doesn't result in perennial contention and Hinkie gets fired, the spin will be that the plan sucked and no one should ever do it again. It won't be just that, you know, Hinkie didn't draft well. You know,
yeah, that's the idea. That's it.
Which
and
is wrong.
People point out the Clippers, how the Clippers were in the lottery for so long. The Clippers were in the lottery so long because, like, the lottery begets more bad players. Drafting bad players begets losing. And if you're failing to evaluate good talent, then you can be in the lottery 100 times, but if you keep drafting the wrong guys, then you're not going to do anything with it. It's not a condemnation of the draft. That's just of your player development staff.
Right. But if you don't draft good players, you're going to keep being bad. If you draft players, you'll stop being bad. You'll stop being bad if you keep those players. Sometimes you trade all your draft picks within, you know, whatever.
Sorry.
That was all I had. I don't know if you have more to add, just in general, or if there's anything you want to plug.
Oh, I like the idea of, like, thinking about the future in terms of, because there's so many people. I mean, the Sixers are, like, villainized in some subsets of the community, which is pretty fun for us. And also, for some people, I guess, torture. But it's fun for me because it's like, they're the Sixers. Like, don't – why do you care? Like, let them just – but professional basketball has, like, never mattered this much in Philadelphia since, like, 1983. Like, people don't – people give a shit. You know, they give a shit one way or the other, but they certainly have opinions about it. And it's exciting for at least, like, hey, the Sixers are part of a conversation rather than, like, okay, well, Willie Green's been on the team for 8 years. I'm bored, like that sort of thing. So it's exciting to like that the Sixers are relevant, and I think that's because they're trying new things, and I really can't fault them for trying something different after so many years of just painful sameness. And my only question is, like, if, and for me it's when the Sixers are contending in 3-4 years, or when they trade for a superstar, or when Embiid becomes one, or the next guy they draft, or whoever. Does the conversation turn to, oh, well, this, like, we were wrong. Like, we made fun of the Sixers, and, oh, now they're good. Because the Sixers right now, for the second year in a row, despite the fact that people say they haven't formed a real basketball team, are not the worst team in the league. Back in October, I tweeted out that the Sixers would not be the worst team in basketball. They lost their first 17 games. And fast forward a couple months, they're not the worst team in basketball. Because they draft, they're developing these guys and they're getting better, and Brett Brown's a good coach. So I think some of the narrative is falsely displayed on them, because they talk about how, like, oh, this is an embarrassment, but, like, meanwhile, like, the Bucks last year were worse by 4 games. The Knicks this year are worse. The Lakers are probably going to be worse. Like, it's not, they're not the worst team. So how can you keep, like, putting them up on this pedestal of like, impressive shittiness when these other teams are worse? And so my only question is, like, is there going to be like a collective my bad?
Yeah, I don't think that will happen, because I actually saw someone write the other day that, you know, they're not even good enough at tanking. Like, I saw someone say that because they're not the worst team again, because someone else was accidentally worse than them, their plan sucks, which is just mind boggling to me. But anyway, Parks and Recreation final episode starts in about 20 minutes, and I need to run to the store real quick. But thank you for coming on. Love to have you back when the Sixers are good.
Can't wait for that day.
In 6 months. Everybody check out Michael's work at LibertyBallers.com, one of the best SB Nation blogs that there is, in my opinion. Thanks for coming on, man. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate it, buddy. Thanks a lot.